Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags, bringing you 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We are live now and you can catch it later as a podcast. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, delivering all the essential updates you need, fast and focused. It's Monday, the 26th of August. Coming up on the program, more on a 3 billion rand crooked medical aid scheme, rising Cape sea levels, a threat to the V&A waterfront. The census accuracy debate intensifies and changes to the national minimum wage coming. A special investigating unit probe into suspected fraudulent medico-legal claims has saved the National Department of Health more than 3 billion rand. The SIU finding that over 5 years or so, a single law firm submitted 44 suspected fraudulent claims to the tune of 497 million rand against the Eastern Cape Health Department. That was just one instance. More now from Foster Mahali, who speaks for the National Department of Health. Foster, welcome to you and thank you very much for joining us. It's astonishing that practices like this were allowed to go on for such a long time. Why is that?
Good afternoon to you, Jeremy, and good afternoon to your listeners, and thanks for the opportunity. Definitely, as the Department of Health, as government, we are equally shocked by the finding, these preliminary findings of the SIU investigations into medical legal claims. Look, we could not foresee this coming precisely because of a number of reasons. Number one, the systems, they don't talk to each other. That's why at some point, one lawyer is able to claim, file two claims for the same patients in two different provinces, two different courts, and both of them will succeed. So we want to thank the SIU for this good work that they've done, and we believe that going forward, we are going to put a number of these scrupulous lawyers, the health officials, the other government officials involved in these fraudulent activities behind the bars, because we believe that's where they belong.
I'm hearing that 3 billion rand could just be the tip of the iceberg.
Definitely, because in terms of the work done so far, is the SIU investigations is less than 20%. So more work needs to still going to be done. The journey is still long, so more is still going to be uncovered. More people are still going to be arrested. More money is still going to be saved from the government. And a number of lawyers are going to be expected to refund the state for this money that has been fraudulently claimed.
You talk about the systems not talking to each other. Are there measures now that need to be implemented or are being implemented to ensure that claims like this can't occur in the future?
Yeah, no, there are a number of measures that are going to be put in place. Number one is the issue of patient safety, because some of these lawyers, they will claim money saying this is for future medical care and loss of income. So now we say as government, we are going to use the same strategy employed by RAF, Road Accident Fund, where we say, no, we are not going to pay you, the lawyers, the money for future medical care. We will be able to take care of this patient ourselves. So we're not going to pay this lump sum. That's number two. Number three, because there's also the issue of stealing medical records. As you know, that currently, especially in the public sector, most of the records are still paper records. So we are now at advantage with the process to install a system where all the medical records of the health system, they are going to be electronic, meaning that sitting in Toyando, you'll be able to see the medical records of a patient in Western Cape. So that we believe that is going to assist us, especially against the theft of medical records.
I do accept that, but that you will concede is a long-term solution. What are you going to do immediately to stop this from happening?
Immediately, as already Minister has said, he sent a warning shot to both the legal firms, the legal practitioners, the health officials, the officials in the Department of Justice, those who are in collusion with the healthcare, with the lawyers to claim all this fraudulent, this money fraudulently, to say, we are coming to you, and we gave them 2 weeks to say, for those who have knowingly submitted fraudulent claims, they need to withdraw. Otherwise, we are going for them. The SIU is going to strike.
Indirectly, this fraud uncovered by the SIU could have an impact on the quality of patient care in those affected regions, and that is of concern.
No, definitely. Remember, the government, the department, we don't budget for this medical legal claim settlement, these billions of rands. So it means once the court has found against us, it means we have to cut the budget from HR, we have to cut budget from healthcare services in order to settle the claim. So that's why in most cases you will hear people say, no, we are unable to appoint the doctors, the nurses, and also to improve some of the infrastructures, because the money has been fraudulently stolen by some of our healthcare workers and some of the legal firms under the name of claimants or the patients. Some of the claimants or the patients, they've never even set their foot in our health facilities. But because of this unholy coalition between the lawyers and the government officials, we end up paying this. We believe that now this is going to come to an end with working with the SIU and other law enforcement agencies.
Foster Mahali, thank you very much indeed. Speaks for the National Department of Health.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, the Statistician General, Risinga Maluleki, says Stats SA faced huge problems delivering the 2022 census, which has been criticized for having the largest undercount in history. Budget cuts have been cited as one big contributing factor. I'm going to talk now to Padi Lehotla, who is the former Statistician General. And firstly, do you think budget constraints impacted the accuracy?
I wouldn't attributed to budget constraints. It's more to do with the environment in which the census was undertaken. But having said that, the point is, you know, a census always undercounts. If you undercount by more than 5%, you have to adjust the numbers, because the numbers drive budgets, drive allocations to provinces. Now, when you have a mechanism by which you can adjust, then there is not a serious problem. The only thing is, if I was missed in the census and I wanted to participate and I'm one of the 30%, I feel very uncomfortable and unhappy. But that's all that there is to it. Of course, there are other statistics or rare events, that such as the number of children born, and then the subset of that, which is the number of children that died, which, when you have such high levels of undercount, then there are serious biases in how those numbers are reflected in the census. So you have to resort to other sources of information, which is basically, we have a very advanced system of registration, vital registration of births and deaths. So we know the number of children that die, but we may not pinpoint them to household and household conditions. But a smart analyst will always bring those data together, because they are also, in terms of deaths, they are by local authority, by municipality. So nothing is seriously lost when you have a 30% undercount. It's undesirable, but it doesn't say that the data is not useful. The data is useful and can be used. The idea that it is not, it's wrong.
You speak about the environment not being conducive in 2024. What does that mean?
Oh, in 2022?
Yes.
When the census was undertaken. I mean, there was COVID, there were all kinds of things that came. And of course, at that point in time, the organization had gone electronic census, which is certainly the future in terms of a collection of data. These gadgets are very, very useful. But when you go into that operation at that point in time, you confront these kinds of problems. But having said that, when you have tools of adjustment with, as I say, did adjust with, the data is fine. I mean, you got the numbers by province. You don't have an outrageous number in terms of the estimate of the population, the nationally, by province. All those numbers are very consistent and coherent. By the way, when I was statistician general, there were deliberations around whether we should run a census every 5 years or every 10 years. I considered to a 10-yearly because one of the things that Dr. Murudu, who was a head of research in my office, did something very fantastic using the ZIF, which is a gravity model, to estimate population sizes going forward based on previous censuses. And his estimate was so accurate for the census of 2011. And when we ran the census of 2011, those projections were a speeding distance from what we got in the census of 2011. And you can use the same projection models to move to census 2022 to match the adjustments that SSA has already done for the undercount.
As things stand at the moment, are there potential consequences of the undercount for short-term policy making and resource allocation?
Not really, when you think about the resource allocation, because it's based on the number of people, the population size for each one of those at the province, at the municipal level, not really. Then you have a narrow but important estimates for things like mortality, fertility. But those mortality and fertility are generally national aggregates that get measured in that kind of way because they get impacted by migration. So when we complain about mortality and fertility data not being released because of quality concerns, indeed, they shouldn't. But there are substitutes that are even more superior because you have an administrative data that records the number of children that are born and those that die. Then having gotten that by space, in space and time, you can actually embed them in the districts and municipalities and then use and adjust the census data by those. But by themselves, as emanating from the census data, it would be wrong to publish them when you know that they are biased.
So,
and that's what the Statistician General has done.
What then, in your opinion, does Stats SA need to do in terms of changing its approach for future censuses to avoid a similar issue of a 31% undercount?
Well, I mean, this whole practice of 5,000 years old, started in China, Egypt, and all those, and of course adopted as a modern census undertaking of door-to-door trying to capture information. In terms of public mobilization and visibility of solidarity of nations, it's a very important exercise, but it is old-fashioned. The Scandinavian countries now use only register-based censuses. And with these gadgets that we have, a register-based census is possible. Moving to that is the critical way of moving away from this 10-yearly interval when the world actually changes almost every 5 or 3 years. So you can have a continuous census by using digital devices, which the Scandinavians, by the way, managed quite early when they started registering their populations. On the African continent, the priests used to keep parish records of who is born, who has died. Now, you need to adopt that as a national effort. With Home Affairs, for instance, in South Africa, that record is already there of people who die, who migrate, and so on. But then in the absence of an address system, that is when you don't have a physical address, then that system collapses, and we don't have physical addresses in South Africa. We tried to have those when I was still in office, but the intra-fights by departments that collapse the system, despite Mokoem Mokoeng having said, we need these addresses in order to propel democracy. You remember during the time of the election?
I do.
There were opposition to elections because there were no addresses. Right. That issue has not hitherto been addressed.
All right. Paddy Lhotla, I'm going to leave it there. Former Statistician General, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, you might be aware the Department of Employment and Labour has gazetted a notice calling for inputs on the national minimum wage, specifically related to changes next year. So what is on the mind of organised labour? From Kasatu, Matthew Parks, a very warm welcome to you. And among stakeholders, and particularly those who've got to pay out money, Matthew, is there an appetite for significant adjustment to the minimum wage, do you think?
Good afternoon, Jeremy. Thanks for having us. We think there is. We have to address many issues simultaneously. It's not an easy thing. But the Minimum Wage Act correctly binds government and the Minimum Wage Commission, which provides a recommendation to the Minister of Labour, to say that you must make sure that you adjust the minimum wage annually to protect it from inflation, but also to ensure it retains its capacity to help address and alleviate poverty and inequality. So that's in the act itself. So it's not just a question of saying, yes, we can or we won't do it. They have to do it. We're pleased that, you know, since it was introduced in 2019, we managed to always ensure that it had received a healthy inflation plus increase, even during the most difficult times. And it is a balancing act, as you're kind of hinting, Jeremy, that when you recognize the difficult economic situation we're in, the high levels of unemployment, you want to avoid retrenchments, but simultaneously also appreciate that workers are highly indebted, especially low-income workers, and they bear a much higher rate of inflation than the average people would, average person would, because one, they have less disposable income, and two, the goods that workers would buy, like electricity or pay for transport or food, often have much higher inflation rates than the average CPI. So we have to juggle it. But I think from our side, we're making our submission as COSATU to recommend an inflation plus increase. And I think also we're keen to see how to help boost compliance. But I think for us, this is a positive step forward as a country in terms of reducing poverty and inequality.
Matthew, let me suggest to you that the inflation calculation is fairly straightforward, but it's part two that you've referred to, which is perhaps more difficult and a little more amorphous. How do you address the whole quotient of having to address living with poverty? And how do you arrive at a figure that is going to be equitable so that it balances the need for wage increases on the one hand, but also the necessity of keeping businesses financially viable? It is, as you say, a juggle, a very delicate balancing act.
No, it is. And it is. And, you know, at times some of our colleagues have said, well, don't give any increase. The economy is bleeding. But if you took that route, you'd actually plunging workers into absolute poverty, further in debt. They wouldn't survive, you know, because inflation is real, and it's especially real for people with low income. Since it came into effect, we've always had an inflation and plus increase, and it's varied between 1% and 3%. So you try to find the right balance. And you also want to avoid a scenario where some of the workers, like farm and domestic workers, are very vulnerable to retrenchment, even to automation, etc. So you have to find the right level that is not too high that it provokes retrenchments, but equally that it's meaningful enough that it gives some substantial relief to workers, especially the poor. And also it benefits the economy too, because when workers have extra money in their pocket, that money is not put under the mattress necessarily. It's spent buying food, paying for transport, buying electricity. So there's a stimulus effect into the economy as well. So it circulates. I think we've gotten the right balance each time. If there's a company which generally can't afford a minimum wage, they can apply for an exemption to the department, but they would have to consult with their workers and their unions, and they would also have to submit their financial statements confirming, yes, indeed, they can't afford it. Then they would be granted an exemption within parameters. And half the companies who have applied have received it. But I think for us, it's about we've got the right approach. We use a lot of independent research from universities to say, what can different sectors of the economy afford, from agriculture to restaurants, etc., where it really becomes relevant, but also what will help to lift people up from poverty. And I remember, you know, about a decade ago, Jeremy, when you had the uprising of farm workers in the Durrans in the Western Cape, where farm workers were getting as little as 6 rand an hour, couldn't even buy half a loaf of bread. Today it's 27.58, so almost the equivalent nearly of two loaves of bread. So there has been progress, but the minimum wage itself is not going to resolve all of our issues. It's one tool in a variety of tools. Ultimately, the solution is to grow the economy, to create jobs, to boost income levels, etc., and reduce the cost of living. But this is one important, significant tool, and we also have to see how to constantly seek to improve compliance as well.
Matthew Parks is the Parliamentary Coordinator for COSATU. Thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, this is an item from the Daily Maverick, and the Cape Wheel, located on the water's edge at the V&A waterfront, says the publication, may come under threat in future because of sea level rise. With this looming threat, the V&A waterfront, one of Cape Town's most prominent landmarks, is now preparing to deal with the SLR, as it's called, or sea level rise, in the short and long term, as well as impacts on its coastal tourism development. I do want to explore that a little further. It does, on the surface, sound worrying, doesn't it? And Anton Cartwright is with us now, founder at Econologic and Credible Carbon and researcher at African Centre for Cities. And Anton, I want to start with this, an overview maybe on the short-term projection in terms of sea level rise.
Well, I always think of sea level rise when you span across all climate change risks, as I think it's a phrase that appeared in that article, as the super tanker of climate change risks. What I mean by that is it's the one with probably the longest time frame over which it plays out. And what that means is, in terms of short-term risk, it's probably not that severe, or we certainly thought it wasn't going to be that acute in the next 5 to 10 years. Really what people have been focusing on is 2050 and beyond, because we know that as even after the atmosphere has stopped warming, and that's a goal that we are trying to reach and still hoping to reach by 2050, even after the atmosphere has stopped warming, the oceans will keep rising. So it's a long-term risk. The short-term risks are not classically considered as very acute, but the combination of climate change-induced weather events and the little bit of sea level rise that we have already, so 21 centimeters probably is our best guess, we are already beginning to see impacts in certain places.
So what are those impacts? What does a 21-centimeter rise actually look like?
So 21 centimeters doesn't sound like very much to most people. You know, it's less than a ruler. The tidal flux on a daily basis is much more than 21 centimeters, even around Cape Town. The point about that is that that's the platform that's being raised. Okay, that's the mean sea level increment that we've got. And then on top of that, you have a tidal impact, and that's not a constant impact. So some tides are much higher than other tides, but that's perfectly predictable. And then on top of that, you have these weather events, which we now know are becoming more intense and more frequent as a result of climate change. And it's the combination of a raised platform, let's call it a spring high tide, and then a storm surge, which is a weather event that causes, you know, big waves crashing into coastal interfaces. And that's where damage takes place to infrastructure, sometimes to private property, and sometimes to human life is at risk as well.
So on the commercial side, first of all, then, are there specific measures that buildings or entities need to take to prevent the damage that you refer to?
No, we don't have a standardized system. You know, we don't have a fix for how to protect ourselves from sea level rise. Obviously, it does speak to issues like coastal protection zones, so where you can build. That's both infrastructure and private property. And I think local authorities around South Africa, certainly, and around the world are trying to get better at keeping infrastructure and people out of harm's way. And then it also speaks to the integrity with which you build, right? But actually, the long-term goal is not to try and hold the sea back. That's generally considered a very bad idea, sort of King Canute-ish, if you like. And much more sensible to be aware of the risk and then to, you know, realize that the ocean will find a way in to these land masses, and then to try and manage the water as it comes in. So living with sea level rise is a far more sensible idea than trying to hold the sea back.
Providing you take the right steps in terms of mitigation, and one of those you suggest is building with integrity. So the way in which we construct needs to change. How does that, or how should that happen?
I think there are a number of elements to that. I mean, the first thing is that, and this is a story for Cape Town, where I'm based, you know, we reclaimed land 100 years ago. The foreshore celebrated real estate that is the Victorian Alfred waterfront, the Sea Point Promenade, these all popular areas, that's on reclaimed land. So in the context of sea level rise, trying to reclaim land from the sea is not a good idea. Okay, that's going to be a very expensive idea. Mm-hmm. And then with the infrastructure that we've got, I do think it comes down to, you know, proper foundations, pile drivings that go deep enough and can stabilize a building even when there's water rushing around it. There's a lot of attention globally going on saying, okay, let's let the basement layer flood, right? Whether that's from rivers or from the sea, and let the water come into the underlying basement layer, and we'll try and live above that level. Of course, what makes it all difficult is it depends on a prediction for what we think sea level rise is going to be at a certain time. And we don't have absolute predictions on that.
Anton, strangely, I'm starting to think that it's a good thing that I live in Johannesburg, but let me ask you one other question. Are there lessons or strategies from other global coastal cities that have been successfully implemented?
So everyone always refers to the Dutch, right? The Dutch, for the longest time, have lived below sea level in many communities below sea level. And they have a very sophisticated, engineered, ecological and social system in place to manage sea level rise. How long into the future they'll be able to maintain that system is a question they're asking themselves. And certainly when people in South Africa try and learn lessons, they always look to the Dutch first. And that's not just South Africa, that's almost every country around the world because of their history. I'm not sure how useful that is, in the sense that, you know, the Dutch sort of imbibed the stuff with their mother's milk. Like, they grew up knowing that they were at risk from the sea. They have a whole institutional architecture, a whole social awareness that is kind of tailored around the fact that, you know, they need to manage the oceans and living below sea level. We don't have that culture, certainly not yet. And there are, I think, a number of institutional measures that we could and are beginning to try and put in place. But, you know, that's a long-term, almost sort of social culture that they've built up around living below the ocean. But, of course, the Dutch engineers fly around the world and provide good advice, including to places in South Africa. So we can learn a lot from them. Some of the U.S. coastal cities have paid a lot of attention to this as well. There are. I think generally there are lessons being learnt across cities around the world.
Right. I sense this is a very important question, and thank you for throwing some light on it. Anton Cartwright, appreciate your time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And finally on the program, South Africa's under fives face hunger, neglect, abuse, development issues, all according to the new South African Child Gauge 2024 report. Laurie Lake is a communication and education specialist at the Children's Institute at the University of Cape Town and joins me on the program now. Laurie, first of all then, what is the problem and are things getting worse for this highly vulnerable cohort?
That appears to be the case. This particular report is tracking progress from the adoption of the National Integrated Early Childhood Development Policy back in 2015 until 2022, when the Department of Basic Education took over the lead role for early childhood development in our country. And what we're seeing is an increase in child poverty. We're looking at 71% of young children now living in poor households where the per capita monthly income is less than 1,558 rand a month. So living in households that cannot afford to meet their children's basic needs. And then, therefore, it's not surprising that we are continuing to see really high levels of childhood stunting. And stunting is not just a concern in terms of children being short for age. So it's not just their physical growth that is stunted. It's also their cognitive development. And that starts to have implications for learning, for progress through school. It impacts on their economic prospects in adulthood. And you start to see the ways in which both poverty and malnutrition feed into an intergenerational cycle that is extremely worrying if we're thinking about national development.
And is this due to policy failure or simply this group being victims of the economy or somewhere in between?
I think it's a mix of both of those things. I think we've seen a spike in unemployment, rising food prices that have impacted in particular on poor households. We know that children are disproportionately affected by poverty in South Africa, so they're more likely to bear the brunt of an economic downturn. And in addition, we've seen government introducing austerity cuts to a range of services, including healthcare, social services, and education. So extremely worrying to see both families and the state under pressure. And historically, we haven't been investing sufficiently in the early years of life. We tend to focus our attention on, you know, graduate output, employment, schooling. And yet, as Linda Richter has said so forcefully in the past, learning happens throughout life, but the brain is built only once in the first 1,000 days. And that's from conception until a child's second birthday. And if we're not building a strong foundation there, it becomes increasingly difficult to rectify and address those deficits later on.
Obviously, there are no short-term fixes here, but there is some talk of the restoration of the child support grant.
Yes. So initially, the child support grant was designed to meet the dietary needs of young children. Over time, the value of the grant has been severely eroded by inflation. And the grant at the moment stands at 530 rand per month. And there's very little that you can buy with sort of 17, 18 rand a day. Mm. Maybe a litre of milk, maybe a loaf of bread, definitely not both. So that gives you a sense of how challenging it is for families that are reliant on the grants. And that 530 rand per month is only about two-thirds of the value of the food poverty line. That's 760 a month. And that is sufficient to meet the dietary requirements of the child, but nothing more. There wouldn't be anything left over for clothing, for transport, for electricity, for rent. So even that food poverty line is really not enough to meet the needs of raising a child.
And Laurie Lake, if the trajectory continues, the impact, as you outlined earlier, is just going to exacerbate and get even worse. And that also has a knock-on effect on economic growth in this country.
Absolutely. There's very, very clear evidence that if you're wanting to invest and achieve the maximum returns on your investment, then it's these investments in the earliest years that offer the highest returns. And we're not only selling our children short, literally, we are compromising national development.
I'm going to leave it there. Laurie Lake, thank you very much indeed from UCT. I appreciate your time. And just before I say goodbye, on our online poll today, the primary consideration when adjusting the national minimum wage. We've just been speaking about that. One, ensuring wage increases keep up with inflation. Two, it's about protecting jobs. Or three, balancing increases with a need to keep businesses viable. If you have a view on that, we'd like to hear them. You can either go to our X or our LinkedIn page. That is also our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.